Gotta wait for Corey to fill his water.
Oh man,
I'm just worst.
the worst. Walking all the way over there.
Welcome to the episode 50 of the One Last Sketch podcast. This is a podcast dedicated to science fiction and fantasy and how it interweaves and influences the world around us. I'm Michael.
I'm Marie.
And I'm Corey.
And today we're talking about Parable of the Sower by Octavia E. Butler. Normally, episode 50 would be such a big milestone for a podcast, but especially for us because we release episodes very intermittently.
It's a an achievement, certainly.
I mean, we've been doing this for what, more than 10 years at this point?
Yeah, but really, to celebrate, we're just all in the same room for once.
And we actually put in an effort this year to pick out some books and talk about them before the year was over. So now we're on Corey's pick. Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler, released in 1993. Hey, Corey, why'd you pick this book?
I picked this book because I thoroughly enjoyed it. That's the honest answer. It was haunting and beautiful and terrifying, and I just had a, despite, the heavy subject matter, I had a wonderful time reading it, and it became very quickly one of my favorite books. So I figure if we're all trying to proactively pick a title, I might as well pick one I enjoyed.
I mean, you were already telling me that I needed to read it anyway, so this was just a way to make sure that happened.
Indeed.
So Parable of the Sower is an apocalyptic story. I guess it's taking place during the course of a very slow
It's a
apocalypse.
slow apocalypse dystopia, I think.
It's like the end game of neoliberal capitalism.
We'll get to
Yeah.
that. And now we'll just go into who is Octavia Butler?
Well,
She was one of Harlan Ellison's students, or
I
protege. One of the few black science fiction authors working in the 1990s, maybe one of the only big names beyond Samuel R. Delaney at the time, hugely influential.
It explains to me why I do have a short story collection called Octavian's Brood, which is probably referencing her, because I do know that she's important, but otherwise not other things that she's done.
Well, I was going to ask about our prior familiarity with Octavia Butler's work. Hey, Corey, what's your answer?
Honestly, none. I think I was vaguely aware of the name, like I'd probably heard it, but I'd never read anything by her before. This kind of, I found this book as kind of like a random recommendation through something else, and I decided to read it, and I just ended up really liking it. But I have zero prior knowledge of her work before reading this.
I did know of, I think she wrote, what's it, Xenogenesis? I think she wrote those series and the Lilith's Brood book. So I had seen those on the shelves, but I'd never picked them up. But otherwise, this is also the first time reading anything by her for me.
And I was aware of Octavia Butler as an author, but likewise, this is my first time reading a novel by her. I maybe read a short story way back when, but not enough to really remember anything about it. So we're all first timers, sounds like.
I feel like there's a bit of the Le Guin effect here, where the first time we all read Le Guin, we're all like, why have we not read more of this sooner? And this was kind of the same reaction for me. It's like, why have I not heard of this author before? Why have I not read this author before?
Yeah, and I mean, she's in this big kind of Afrofuturist space that's a world I'm only just kind of starting to read in and around. So it's like there's this whole, kind of subgenre that I think she's one of the forerunners of.
Maybe not a forerunner of, but certainly one of like the bigger voices in.
So Parable of the Sower takes place in the far, far, far future year of 2024. Or I should say that's when it starts. I think it goes to 2027.
Something like
Yeah,
that, yeah.
2027.
So what's maybe really discouraging about reading this book is that this was written in 1993, and it's a very bleak future. And reading it in 2023, this is still a plausible future for next year.
Yeah, honestly, it's very distressing. I'm like, yep, Looks like she predicted everything.
I mean, it's one of those frightening books that got a lot right, and that's quite terrifying because of how bleak a worldview it depicts. And you'd like to think that maybe there is still some hope. Which, to be fair, the novel is not without hope for the future, but it is accepting of, the dark reality it's living through.
Like it's actually, I think that's almost like a flood sort of thing. Like there's going to be a massive like issue, extinction, destruction, not from like a natural event, from a economically wrought event, a political event, but you get the sense of that there is the far future because there's the whole Earth Seed movement that we'll probably talk about a bit more, but that it's most of us aren't going to make it, is the sense that I get from it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've mentioned it being an apocalyptic novel, but as you mentioned, it's the political situation. I think that is a common theme throughout the book, is that how many problems are caused by humans, and so approaches humans can take to fix our own problems.
This takes place in Southern California to start out with, and goes through a migration narrative essentially from Lauren Olamina, the main character. And it takes place in the United States that the state exists or people want it to exist, but the government doesn't really do anything per se. So it's in a state of anarchic decay that's further along than we are, but maybe not as far away as I would hope.
Yeah, I mean, there's a like the whole background is that you have people have really kind of broken off into like local communities, and it starts off in a like smaller walled community, but ultimately, as everything is breaking apart and people are looking for resources, the American ethos of every man for himself is perhaps generating a certain amount of destruction. And that is like wreaking havoc, and it's wreaking havoc along class and race lines because obviously Octavia Butler is a black writer, and her central character Lauren is black in this. And it's clear that like if you're white, you're better off in this universe, which is true in ours as well economically. So it's takes like a lot of those kind of pressures and brings them out to into this work of fiction, but it's really not that far off. It's disturbing how close it is to, I think, to reality.
Well, I think one thing you've kind of both touched on that is worth remembering as well is that it's a very localized narrative. The first, what third of the book, she's literally living in, the main character is literally living in like effectively a gated community. And then even the migration, it's only across California. This is not a globe-trotting adventure. This is not even a national scale. It's very much focusing on the local. And I do think part of that is that it is intentionally rooted in, the experiences of a Black American woman, right? Which, I mean, we can obviously not speak to at all, because
We
no.
are the worst reviewers for this book in this case. I guess that's our 50th anniversary gift to ourselves.
But at the same time, like, I do think it's, I don't know if it's this one or more in the sequel, it does kind of touch on the idea that, many of these problems she's focusing on are American problems. And yes, environmental collapse, economic catastrophe do have the power to threaten the whole world. But in this case, there's kind of this impression that it's hitting the United States a lot worse than other areas. And I think that's meant to be a commentary on American culture, right? She's making the claim that, all of these horrible things are happening largely because of our worldview and our way of life, we being Americans, because, we're all Canadians.
Yeah, in this universe, Canada is behind a wall of like a now I think a military guarded wall of a border, which I think is in this world is probably going to be correct. But actually, I'm just thinking about it. It occurs to me this is like a much better version of Foundation because if you're thinking about like sociological forces, this takes into account all of them and not just what somebody like Isaac Asimov would consider. Like she starts from this point of view of being like the preacher's daughter because her father, the father of the character Lauren, is Baptist. minister as well as I think a university professor. So she's kind of like a privileged person within her own community. And then like sort of the how the like local community is able to establish and help it help each other and create something that is, you know, surviving or carrying on until like larger forces of ultimate destruction kind of break it open. And those forces though are not like unintelligible because there's groups of people who rove around who are addicted to substances and like to set fires, but they seem to have their own ethos of like the anarchy there is meant to be kind of like a reassignment of wealth to everybody by like destroying anyone who would be considered wealthy because everybody else is destitute. So it's sort of like you see that sort of political and economic force that makes sense to each other. And then later, as they're traveling along again, like community is made. And it becomes clear that community is a thing that will get you through despite the larger forces, like the physical pressure of being like a climate refugee, which they all are effectively in this.
I mean, you talk about people who are even more destitute than these characters. I think that's one interesting thing the narrative picks up on is the idea that, yes, people living a middle class existence are more well off than people who are living in abject poverty. But at the same time, there is still an awareness of an ultra wealthy class that is still able to separate themselves from this and not be horribly affected by it.
You definitely get a sense of like what we call now like seasteaders and like that kind of group existing. And as they're making like new sort of what are those towns?
Company towns.
Company, like basically novo company towns, indentured servitude coming back.
There's constant reference to people, getting jobs with rich families where they're literally just working for room and board. Like they are indentured slaves in all but name. And it's that interesting notion of who bears the brunt of catastrophe, right? Because there are always going to be people in positions of power whose, wealth and privilege allows them to extricate themselves from it, despite the fact that they were the ones who probably had the most say in causing what happened and suffered the least consequence of it.
And there's also like the feminist narrative in here that, you know, women are vulnerable victims within this universe, have more trouble. If for example, Lauren chooses to appear male to like avoid being attacked just because just to not appear so much a victim to other groups when they're starting out earlier to begin with. And that's kind of making me think about for the time period that this was published in, because as I read some of these things now, I'm like, yeah, I've encountered these kind of material in other kind of works by similar artists, but I wonder if at the time if it would have been more shocking or not. I'm kind of feeling like maybe people would have thought it was far-fetched, or maybe, but I'm kind of like, I think she's just correct on most
It's
things.
definitely considering the socioeconomic effects of climate change at a date far earlier than I'm used to seeing from the genre. Like there's the genre subgenre of climate fiction, cli-fi, unfortunately shortened to that.
Oh no.
But that comes quite a bit later from the time that Octavia Butler was writing. And just to bring back to the idea of the privileged class in Parable of the Sower, we never see anything from their point of view. I think all of the characters are either Black or Hispanic, and even though they might be in a relatively privileged position in society of being in a gated community, it's not the actual politicians who are leading things.
Harry is white, because that's an explicit point that when they're first starting, and it's just Harry, Lauren, and Zara, that Harry is white, and they're worried about like what being a mixed race group means. So, yes, but yeah, there is a lot of like the and the whole gated community had a Spanish name, so I think it was already a kind of like Black Hispanic group, or probably we'd say Latinx group. To begin with like a few white people in it, but yes, otherwise not many, not many.
Yeah, I mean, we do have news reports of there's this politician who came in, and of course, the guy who gets elected, his whole promise is that he's going to fix things by doing exactly what's going to make things worse. So that's explicit to anyone from outside the privileged class to see, even though they're like, well, we need a change, but there's no change. It's just going down this seemingly inevitable pathway
I
towards
mean,
destruction.
to just say what we're all tiptoeing around, this book and more so its sequel accurately predicted Trump. Like it accurately predicted what Donald Trump would do to get into power. It accurately predicted the kind of world that if he didn't make real, fortunately, he was at least pushing for.
Well, and that still may come. I think that's the thing about it is I'm like, this is still highly plausible as an outcome now, right? I thought I wasn't certain because the name of the president is Donner. And I was like, is that at all? I wondered related to like the Donner Party as like a reference. Because that ended in a tragedy as well, but
It
probably not.
is a nice juxtaposition of just inevitable death due to hubris.
And bad planning.
Well, and again, I think one of the foundations of what this narrative is doing is it is taking a pot shot at the end consequences of, a capitalist neoliberal society endgame, right? Like I think it is very much, not to say it's not applicable to other countries, but it's very much rooted in the American experience.
I've been consuming a certain amount of content from TikTok and adjacent kind of platforms about like eat the rich kind of content right now because this idea of the like one percenters and a lot of the stuff is actually a lot is really showing that there's like a big divide between what people might call middle class and people who are living like under the poverty line. And it's like, and then there's these couple of very small number of people who are like truly like egregiously rich. We need more of them to implode in submarines, I think. And
You heard it here first.
yeah, the hot take. And it's just like when you're like when you have like absolutely nothing, how just being barely comfortable is wealth. And it's like that's. And it's like you see that there's this huge group of this massive population just eating each other, just destroying each other, and then literal cannibalism as a sort of metaphor, I think, for that.
Among other things, I keep coming back to it because it's the obvious one, but commentary on America, right? You've got a society that's ultra competitive, that pushes competition. And so when you create a situation where a lot of people have nothing, people who have just base level security seem wealthy by comparison, and that's going to cause, violence. That's going to cause people to clash and people to fight over what's available.
And I think because it's very clear that some companies like that are like water vendors or they're still like big stores that are able to hire security guards with lots of guns. Obviously, this is set in America, so guns are everywhere. Guns are a big thing. I mean, in this universe, I understand wanting guns. But then it's clear that it's like just these bastions of being able to like basically create that fortress that is then so impenetrable than things like the little gated community, which just has like some orange trees and like persimmon trees and like people who are kind of helping each other. That's like much easier to destroy and like redistribute than anything else.
To be clear, this is written in the wake of Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., the LA riots. And I was just thinking about this in terms of Octavia Butler's background, that she is extrapolating, but on the other hand, we have this private police force that's represented in this novel that the way that they deal with the population is just how the American police force at this time of increasing militarization of that body would deal with Black people, Hispanic people, still does clearly.
I mean, sorry, just I want to make a point before we get too far out of it. Marie talks about how there's guns everywhere because it's the States. And it's interesting because at no point does the book glorify guns, right? There are gunfights in the book, but they're always desperate acts of survival. They're not action sequences. And it's this notion that violence is so prolific that the tools to do violence become a necessity to survive. Even if you don't want them, you have to have them. And that's kind of, again, the world that many deluded people seem to be pushing for.
I feel like your point about the police, like I think now in a post Black Lives Matter, this seems obvious because we've all consumed a lot more critical race theory since that time. But I think if I had read this a while ago, like prior to having, prior to becoming aware of that, I might have found it like probably too futuristic or extrapolated. Whereas I think a lot of people who would be in Black Hispanic communities would relate with this much more strongly from the outset because it's the knowledge within that community of like that's what it's like. And now when I read it, I'm like, yeah, why would you ever go to the police? Because in this universe, they do nothing. They take your money, they steal stuff from you, and they imprison you for no good reason, which
Yeah,
is
and
distressingly accurate.
you mentioned reading this in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement. There was nothing that Black Lives Matter brought to light that was new for the afflicted communities. The people it was new and shocking for were people like us who've never had those kind of interactions with police.
Yeah, and Butler is speaking from a community that felt the negative impacts of the economic policies of Reagan, George Bush Sr., etc. first. Other people in other groups were insulated from that, but eventually, as happens in this novel, it will come for you. This you're safe until you're not, and you allow other groups to be affected and crushed down, thinking that it will never happen to you.
Like that, it's like when you think about this kind of messaging and information, it's like on the backs of what? Right? So like, it's when you kind of read something like this and then you recognize that it's like, much of the things that if you're a white person for as we are, all three of us, you have to recognize that everything that's most everything, I think I'll just say everything, perhaps it's hyperbole, but it's I think it might not be is because somebody else is suffering
Yeah,
right
you
ways.
don't feel those effects because other people do, and it is intractable, and there is no way that the system works where that does not happen. And that, I think, speaks to why there were a lot of these kind of future dystopia, maybe not a lot, but a lot of well-regarded ones that were coming out in the 90s at the same time by people of different backgrounds, and yet Parable of the Sower feels much more pertinent or immediate than those other imagined futures do.
I think that's because Parable of the Sower is probably most strongly rooted in a real person's experience. Like, as much as I love 1984, George Orwell never lived in that kind of world. Octavia Butler is just writing about the world, like very clearly writing about a world she lived in, and the extrapolations she makes are not far-reaching.
Yeah, like the idea that the fire department, you can't come because you can't pay for them. If you're living within a privileged position, like, well, that's ridiculous. Of course, if my house was on fire, if I called, the firefighters would come. And all that's happening in Parable of the Sower is that that treatment is being widened to a greater swath of the population as the state breaks down.
And it just makes very like clear. It's like we are so close. I mean, and lots of activists and philosophers and critical race theory would say we are already back in slavery, or it has never gone away in terms of like the interactions we have with each other or our economic system, etc. And just like how easily people, what's the, I can't remember the name of the like company town that's being set up. I think it's Oliver or something. It's like when you have the choice between like this world that's just crumbling and then being forced to work and all your future generations forced to work, you can see how that choice would become appealing and maybe the only thing you make.
Well, and again, I think one of the kind of privileged positions the book does recognize is that being able to be concerned about these things is in many ways a privilege. If you literally have nothing, then stability is very appealing. If you have enough to get by, then you can afford to be critical of people who would choose stability over, freedom. And it's like, well, that's an unfair judgment to be making. And to the point you just made, I know that there are many experts on this who know far more about it than any of us do that have quite articulately made the point that the American prison system effectively exists just to recreate slavery.
I mean, there are points of like optimism in this. It's the parable of the sower. There's a future that is presumed to be possible. There is working with a new, making a new community out of the people who are most in need of each other works. And also, I'd say the fact that Lauren used education, used knowledge, showed that it's like there are still things that are valuable that can't really be like just in sort of a physical material economy, right? That's like valuable to have and do.
Well, that's kind of the book's main, one of the book's main arguments is that the only way to oppose this kind of destructive, anarchic, like free-range capitalism, this, you know, forced impoverishment, the only way you can build a better future is to build a community, to build a community and to educate it. The solution to, you know, cutthroat individualism is collective action, right? And it's collective action on a small scale in the case of this book, but it is still a collective act, right? Lauren may kind of end up leading a community, but she's not leading a community just by herself. She's building a community to work together.
Yeah, like if you take it as like a feat to go, like at the end of the story, they get to a relatively possibly safer, viable place to live. However that plays out in the next book, I don't know. I haven't read it yet. But it's like they brought a lot of women and a lot of children to that place, which in this sort of, it's not Mad Max because that's like a white dude's idea of the apocalypse, but in this sort of very chaotic, violent world, where full of, you know, rape and all kinds of other things, they get like through that.
I mean, it's not to say that there are no men who join the community and no men there at the end, but I think it's an important point that the community is largely female and largely children, because it's people who are going to look at things other than just the action hero perspective.
Well, it's not largely children. That's still one word. It's only three of them.
Sorry, but it's women and kids, but like it's people who are not going to, who haven't been raised on this action hero fantasy, who haven't been fed this like white male power fantasy that you just need to take everything because it's just waiting for you to do so. It's people who've been the victims of that fantasy realizing it doesn't work, so looking for better alternate ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this sounds like a very bleak setting, and it is.
Yep.
Obviously, if you haven't read this book, there are quite a few warnings in terms of content, mm-hmm. of what's in it. But the interesting thing about it is that there is a huge focus on empathy in Parable of the Sower, and it's actually a key part of the narrative and the main character's personality and situation, because Lauren Olamilla has a condition which is referred to as hyper-empathy, where she experiences what she sees happening around her, even if it's not real, even as a simulated experience. Mm-hmm. She feels so deeply what other people are going through that it can be debilitating towards her. And while this may put her out of action, it is in fact the key reason she's able to create the community that mm-hmm. she does, or has the ideas that she does that lead to that community.
Well, I think an important aspect of that, could you just mention other people? She doesn't, it doesn't affect her with animals, I don't believe.
Like a little bit, but less so.
Yeah. So simply put, like when she sees somebody in pain, she immediately feels and experiences that pain. When she sees somebody feeling joy, she's able to share in joy. Like she does mention how one of the few benefits of it is that when she has a sexual partner, he's able to feel what they're feeling. So it makes it doubly pleasurable. And that's about the only good thing, because it's like if she sees someone stub their toe, she'll feel like she stubbed her toe. If she sees someone get shot, she feels the pain of being shot. And it's this really interesting dynamic where this character is made incredibly vulnerable because of empathy, but that's also kind of a source of strength because she's able to endure this kind of massive amount, these massive amounts of suffering, and she's able to understand other perspectives and other people because she feels such high levels of empathy.
It kind of brings her to like also certain proficiencies, because I mean, there's lots of guns in this story and she shoots other people. And when she shoots someone, she feels them dying. But she's sort of learned to be a very good shot because she can't afford to sort of miss and have somebody else be in pain, she has to sort of end it, which, and then she's down for the count for a while after that.
Because if she hits them and they're in pain, she's going to see that and she's going to be debilitated as well. Which, when you're running for your life, yeah, like you said, you can't afford to be in that situation.
Kind of coming from a funny sort of criticism, because it's clearly like a crack baby kind of background, because the reasoning for it, and this hyper empathy even manifests as like a physical thing, because it, and she's not the only person. It's said that it's some kind of made up drug that was maybe a painkiller, possibly a stimulant, it's not really clear, that her mother took when she was pregnant with Lauren, and then she has this hyper empathy syndrome where even if she sees like a wound, like she would bleed as when she was a child. And she's not the only one in the world. And actually, there's other people later at the group that do have this same sort of, I'm going to call it capacity rather than condition because that's the phrasing for it. But it's interesting how it's like coming out of what's originally sort of her father sees as like a liability only comes out to be like a strength.
Well, I mean, what's interesting, kind of along those lines too, I think that aspect of the narrative is probably drawing on one of two things. I think Octavia Butler was probably old enough to have met people who had been, thalidomide babies. So that's probably something she'd be drawing on. But the notion of crack babies were a very hot button issue at the time this was written, which, as we know now, that was basically propaganda used to demonize, poor black mothers. That wasn't actually true.
Listen to the You're Wrong About Crack Babies episode for more information.
Yes, shout out to another podcast that is amazing and probably doesn't know where we exist because we're too small.
Or
But
needs our shout out in any way, but anyway.
sure. Yeah, but right, it's taking this narrative of, oh, these people were bad mothers and they were bad, bad people, and it's showing that no, their children were still people. They themselves were still people and there was suffering because of this. This was not like this was just people shirking parental responsibility.
Well, and it was an institutional reason that led to the use during pregnancy in the first place, right? So that's another parallel there.
And it's not a massive element of the narrative, but it does touch on, drug culture and the plague of drug culture being pushed on impoverished people, especially impoverished black people in Southern California.
Well, if we just run with that briefly, there is the like pyromaniac group, because there is another sort of hallucinogen drug out there in this world that's just called pyro that makes fire setting sort of pleasurable, or people have hallucinatory
When people
experiences with
experience,
it.
when people see fire, they have these like euphoric experiences. So it causes them to go light fires, like massive fires.
But we don't really know, like allegedly that's what happens. We don't really get what the story is, but that gets tied into this sort of group of drug culture people who are in this very sort of nihilistic phase of like burn everything, and it literally just sort of makes it easier.
Well, and correct me if it might be the sequel I'm thinking, but I think at some point the theory or the idea is also explored that, these massive fires are not actually being started by addicts. They're being started by people who are using addicts as the cover, right? So it's like when you de when you
Say a sequel.
Oh, sorry.
I didn't know that. Thanks for the spoilers, Meteor.
It's not a massive dimension of the story, but it's the notion that, people are claiming those who are committing violence are one group, when in fact it's another group demonizing those people to justify their own
Oh,
actions.
so it's Dare.
I'm making this sound like a more important aspect of the sequel than it is, but it is touched on.
But we did drift away a little bit from the hyper empathy. Don't know if there's more you want to say on that,
In an earlier discussion, you pointed out that the hyper empathy becomes relevant to the time period this was written because it's pushing a worldview that was being pushed away, that particular political movement.
Again, tail end of Reagan and Thatcher, individualism is rampant, me, 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 screw everyone else. And when that's what's being pushed, how do you counter that? You counter that by reminding people that no, we need to be empathetic. Other human beings are other human beings. They're not game pieces or obstacles to be pushed aside for our own benefit.
And there is a kind of a thing, because there's an implication that lots of people who would be like landowners, slave owners in this universe target people who have hyper empathy because they quote unquote make good slaves, because it's easy to hurt the person. And that's just like exactly the kind of view that you can imagine like Being in the sort of like 1% landowner class, you'd have in that sort of economic background. Yeah. Well, that was going somewhere and then it
I mean,
didn't.
Lauren does meet other people who have hyperempathy syndrome. The euphemism they use for each other is sharers because you share other people's feelings and sensations. And again, that kind of becomes another part of community. It's all of these people who have this very overt vulnerability, so they band together to help make each other stronger and to help increase their chances of survival. I mean, basically, it's a microcosm of what society is supposed to be. Right, we work together because that helps us all survive, not we ignore each other because then nobody can take care of us on their own.
I think the funny thing about the like the character Lauren and like what she's sort of proposing, like for the on the ground now kind of stuff, none of it's really radical. It's really very practical and very much like, I don't know, maybe we just helped each other, it wouldn't be so awful kind of thing.
And that might be why this book, kind of stood out among its contemporaries, because that's actually a very grounded real-world solution that works,
It's
right?
very small.
Yeah, you start by helping people, right? You don't need to talk about, this like crazy tech utopia in the like way off in the distant future that we might be able to make when you can talk about literal ways we can make the world better now.
Well, man, guys, it's totally because like Canada's on fire this entire summer and we got people trying to shoot out into space. Oh boy, this is a depressing book to read right now.
I mean, it was a depressing book to read last year too.
Yeah,
So,
probably before too. Yeah.
within Parable of the Sower, Lauren acts as a kind of messiah. So kind of, she is a messiah. She was the founder of a religion that will become widespread later on. She's trying to get her story down before it can be corrupted, essentially, by her followers. This we have considered at least three other science fiction fantasy books on this podcast that are about messiahs. So add another one to the list.
So, Dune, Book of the New Sun, and
Nausicaa.
yes.
So far, the ladies are doing better anyway.
Contrast it to some of those other titles, in the case of Dune, it's a messianic narrative about a person who doesn't want to be a messiah because they know that will lead to, jihad and inquisition and genocide. In the case of the Book of the New Sun, it's a lying narrator, so you can't really trust that he actually is. And in the case of Nausicaa, he's actually a very similar character. She's someone who uses empathy and compassion and kindness to change the world, not brute force and violence.
So what do we think about the books of the living, which is what the books that Lauren is writing that are essentially snatches of poetry? She doesn't, at least at the beginning, seem to have any intentional movement to make this the founding set of texts for a new religion. It's just,
So
these are my thoughts of the world and how it fits together. And then through the course of the book, realizing what those foundations are and how they will affect and spread to other people.
yeah, so for a little bit of context, Earthseed as the religion that she creates is not a religion with a deity. There is no afterlife, there is no higher power. Their fundamental tenet is that God is change. The world is constantly in flux, it is constantly being changed. So, that is like the force that would be God. But because God is change, you as a person have the power to shape change. And you have the power to shape change for the worse, but you also have the power to shape change for the better, which is what she's, I mean, effectively, that's what all of the teachings boil down to. They're all about how do you actually think? How do you ask questions? How do you change things to be better? How do you approach an unjust system and actually look at it? Like, so in that regard, I could think of worse things to build a faith structure around.
Yeah, like it's not a new idea. I'd say that really nothing she writes in her text is like novel in sort of like philosophy or theology, but it's novel in the context of like she's a Baptist. They're like a Baptist community. So when you think about sort of what like texts like the Bible mean for that kind of a religion, this is a very different and like a wildly different sort of style.
I mean, another character even makes the point after being introduced to the kind of the tenets of Earthseed that it sounds a lot like she's drawing on, Taoism, Buddhism, and a few other beliefs. And I think she makes the comment that yes, yeah, she probably is, but Lauren's perspective on Earthseed throughout the entire story is not that she created something, it's that she just realized things that were kind of self-evident in the world.
Yeah, and I mean, it's called Earthseed because her fundamental view is that like we're humans are meant to like spread out through the stars
Yeah, the
from
destiny of
Earth.
Earthseed is to travel to the stars. Like, she believes in a world where we are able to, very similar to Star Trek in many ways, we are able to properly deal with the problems facing us to establish ourselves in a position where we can then travel out into the cosmos in search of the answers to those big questions.
I did find in reading them that what they most reminded me of was Ursula K. Le Guin's translation of the Tao Te Ching.
I was actually going to make that point.
Was what they most reminded me of, because they're just sort of little short statements that you would just kind of reflect on and sort of make just general claims, which I think is just different for people who are like used to scripture and like church meaning a particular kind of thing and baptism and that kind of stuff. And it's interesting because it starts from right at the beginning that she states that she, you know, doubts her father's God. And that's kind of a rift she has, like from the beginning, that's secret for her.
Yeah, she keeps it secret from her father, and it's a very key part of who she is from a young age, is that she realizes that this belief structure does not work for me.
And I think it was like can't work for anyone because the whole thing about the community that ultimately like breaks apart and they have to flee from is that her father was kind of what was holding it together, but it's a sort of a it's part of the dying way, I would say it. And she's feeling that
Well,
her that Earthseed's going to be the way of the future.
her father was a charismatic and strong figure in many ways. And I think, I mean, spoilers, he ends up dying, but they never know how he dies. And then, like, within a year or two of his passing, their community is ransacked. But I think the point that's made is that even if he'd been there, he really wouldn't have been able to do much, right? Having that, soul strong figure that you hang everything on. They can't actually do everything. Even if they were there, they wouldn't have made a difference. So you need to find another way other than just relying on this one person.
Technically, he doesn't die, he disappears. Where he's presumed dead.
Yes,
Like
he.
and he is dead for all intents and purposes.
It's very much a world where people disappear without trace all the time.
Like our world.
Yes, but taken to an even more frightening extreme.
We all read the latest edition of Parable of the Sower, which includes an introduction by N.K. Jemisin that talks about Parable of the Sower as a text that grows with you.
That was something that I read a little bit before, but then I did read the text before I after I had read the story. And it talks about reading it in her 20s, 30s, and then her 40s. And this was the 2018 version. So this version came out the same year that N.K. Jemisin published her How Long Until Black Future Month
Which I'm currently reading.
short story collection. And she talks about how in the 20s, she's like, well, this was like the 90s, the dot-com thing. It seemed very far off and sort of unlikely. And I think she just says, I'd like her to go back to writing about aliens. And then when she was in her 30s, it struck her in a different way, becoming like, because at that point she was in her master's, no, sorry, her mid-30s read was when she was first encountering institutional racism. Well, not first, sorry, but she says a career-specific encounter with institutional racism and having a meaning there. And then in her 40s, it's this sort of like punch you in the gut. And this was not that long ago. And I feel like we're getting that kind of like, oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. But also this thin piece of hope in it. And then what will it be like in the mid-50s, I guess is the question.
Yeah, I didn't actually read the introduction. I often don't, but yeah, the idea of it being a book that grows with you, because I remember I said to you both after I read it, I'm like, I wish I'd read this 10 years ago. I think it is a book that, not just on the level of, current events and predictions, getting things right, I think it is a book that reveals a lot of very good truths.
I think that if I had read this 10 years ago, I would have been too ignorant to get it, if I'm honest.
Well, and that's the thing. I think you're probably right. If I'd read this 10 years earlier, I don't think I would have appreciated it on the level I should have. But at the same time, I do wish that, I think when I say that statement, I think what I'm really wishing is I wish I'd had the capacity to properly appreciate this 10 years earlier. Right? Because nobody, at least nobody we know likes to consider themselves to be ignorant. And when you reach a point in your life where you realize how ignorant you have been about certain things, you can either, as so many people do, reject them, or you can try to be better about them.
Well, interesting.
And I am trying to be better about them, and this book, I think, helped me to find ways I can look at being better about them.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, if you do encounter this text earlier, you don't have to believe in Earthseed as a religion, but it's like this concept of what could you change that's going to change the futures for everybody. That's like a good idea to have, especially as we're sitting in this world where everything is on fire, literally. And we see our tech billionaires doing all kinds of things. Yeah.
So Octavia Butler has quite the long tail when it comes to influence. I think she was recognized as a very important author at the time, but maybe took a while before this started to have an effect on publishing. That has nothing to do per se with Octavia Butler, but just with the glacial and terrible pace of publishing to keep up with these kind of things, or to consider these issues that she was tackling really early on. But definitely there are a lot of authors now who cite Octavia Butler as an influence, whereas I don't feel like you heard it that often in, say, the late 90s or early 2000s.
Yeah, and like at the beginning of this podcast, I facetiously was like, I don't know who she is. Because now I'm like, I don't know. I didn't, because this is like a whole like a subgenre almost that I'm coming into sideways. But it's great.
The way I found this book, it wasn't through like normal ways I would find a book. I've been listening to Terry Pratchett's Discworld on audiobook while I've been doing hobby projects. And basically, the reason I'm doing those in audio is because I didn't want to commit to sitting down and reading them. And then the app was like, oh, based on your recommendation or based on your reading history, we think you might like this. And this book popped up, and I read the description. I'm like, I think that's one I actually want to read. That's not something I want to do in audio. And so that was how I found it, and that's what got me to read it. And I'm like, yeah, I'm really glad I read this.
And we were thinking of other sort of people in this genre that we've read that would be related to this. And one we have done a podcast on, that's Nalo Hopkinson, a Canadian writer and Afrofuturist. We did Brown Girl in the Ring, I think.
Michael and I did. You hadn't actually read it at that
It's
point.
true, I hadn't read it then. I've also read, I mean, I've read her short story collection, Falling in Love with Hominids, and
Which is really good.
and her book, The Chaos, which she wrote when she was having a hard time and is worth reading once, I'd say. Maybe not her best work, but yeah.
Well, and you mentioned N.K. Jemisin's Hell Until Black Future Month, which I'm currently in the process of reading, as I said. And yeah, it's a short story collection. All of the stories have been phenomenal so far. She's touched on some very harrowing topics. I'm forgetting the author off the top of my head.
River Solomon
Thank you.
for An Unkindness of Ghosts.
An Unkindness of Ghosts by River Solomon, another piece of Afrofuturism that is absolutely amazing.
We should do a podcast on that one at
We
some point.
should. But like I think what a lot of these narratives have in common is, at least all of the ones we just listed, they are written by Black female authors. And unfortunately, we live in a world where that's a perspective that is often crushed. So for them to actually break through, they have to work that much harder. And don't get me wrong, I'm glad they did break through because they've contributed these wonderful voices that tell us so many important things about the world. And I only hope that as the world moves forward, it continues to become a fairer place where more of those voices get to have their say.
I mean, I'm hopeful I'll go and at some point read Octavia's Brood, which I think was a like mindful collection of like people writing and reflecting on Octavia E. Butler's work and what she means. But I have a feeling that for all of us, we're kind of like, we can know that she had a major influence, but I don't know that we've read a lot of people who have been influenced by her, just from our own personal sort of location in this socioeconomic, political reading landscape.
That's a good point. I think that's a project we could definitely have as individuals to try to find more people. I mean, obviously,
Well,
read more.
change is the only constant, so.
I mean, obviously, we can read more of her work, but we can also read more people she's influenced for sure.
That brings us to the end of Corey's pick.
So that's the end for me.
Again,
That's it.
I will say, if I could have closing thoughts on my pick, It is a phenomenal book. It introduced me to a lot of things that I think I needed to be exposed to and helped change me, what I hope is for the better. And we talk about literature having power, and this is a book that has a lot of power. And if you read it, you are doing yourself a huge favor. And if you don't read it, you are doing yourself a huge disservice.
I mean, obviously, we've been spoiling all kinds of things all over the place, but not so much so that you couldn't actually still, I think, read this and enjoy it. And I think everyone actually should read this, is what I would say. And it even comes in this most recent edition with a book club primer and reading group guide at the end for those of you who might want to read it with other people because you're intimidated by the material. It's still a way for people to do this.
Now, I will actually say on the topic of this, the book does have a sequel. It was meant to be a trilogy. Unfortunately, Octavia Butler died before writing the third one. That being said, both this book and its sequel do have definitive endings. You can just read them as standalones where things work out. More so the second one, but you can still read Parable of the Sower as just a book in its own right and have the story in there.
Yeah, this was an intense read. I'm glad I introduced to Octavia E. Butler this way. It's especially interesting to me as just not following traditional narrative patterns. There is a, I guess you can consider society as a whole as a villain in this, but there's no set villain. There are conflicts, there's lots of violence, but it's not following the typical thread narrative of most science fiction that is a very set plot structure.
Doesn't
And I
need
think
to.
we just need a lot more of that. So,
Yeah.
yes, please be influenced by Octavia Butler.
Yeah. There's no BBEG. We're all suffering. That's why it's bad.
Yeah, and that's very mindful in that it's not just this world is terrible.
Well, it's.
That's it. That's all I have to say.
Yeah.
It's very much these are concrete steps that you can make to make the world less terrible, and you are obligated to do it.
And this is how we got here. That's
Yes.
also
So
laid
it's,
out.
and that this society, this terrible structure that we're in, this was built by people, and it's up to people to tear it apart.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's very much aware of the fact that evil is a consequence. Evil is a consequence of decisions, it's a consequence of actions. It's not something that, mustache twirling individuals sit there reveling in being.
We could make a world where you don't have to, where it isn't just might makes right, etc.
Yeah, so that finishes up two of our picks for the year 2023. That leaves mine another book about changing worlds in a certain sense. It's also a recent release. It is The Terraformers by Annalee Newitz. Thank you for listening. You can find previous episodes of this podcast at onelastsketch.wordpress.com. I am really not on any social media anymore, so
That's a terrible place to
your best
be.
way to get into this podcast and find previous stuff is either on my website or to use one of your podcatchers or subscribe to the RSS feed. You'll generally find it on those podcatchers that are out there.
Yep.
Thank you for listening. That was episode 50. We're done.